Hello, and welcome to a roundtable discussion on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, I'm joined by guests for a lively conversation on a topic we hope you'll find interesting. In this roundtable spotlight, I'm joined by Jason, and we're going to have a discussion on All the Marvels, A Journey to the Ends of the Biggest Story Ever Told, which is a book by Douglas Walk. It was originally published in hardcover, I think, in October 2021. How you doing tonight, Jason?
Doing good, John. How are you doing?
I am doing good. Now, we both read this, what, about a year ago?
Yeah, I believe it was last year.
It was, yeah, and we had talked about doing it as a episode like we're doing now, but, you know, time got away from me. I got a little lost, and you'd kind of mentioned that it was showing up in previews for the softcover edition.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm still game for doing this. Of course, it'd been a year, so when we decided to do it, I know I felt the need to reread it, and I'm pretty sure you reread it as well.
Yes, I reread it and felt like that would be the best way I could give a good, you know, take on it.
Yeah. So I've read the full thing twice. The first time I did it on my Kindle Fire, and I was on internet some of the time, but not all the time. And there's a feature in the Kindle where you can like look up words, and I've got a decent vocabulary, but there were a couple of times it's like, yeah, I need that.
Mm-hmm.
I also realized, because I was highlighting a bunch of stuff, but there were a couple of things. It's like, I don't want to just highlight it. I've got things to say on this. So I'd put in some notes. I cannot type on my Kindle. My
right.
Notes were atrocious. Like, I think that's what it meant. So this time around, when I reread it, I used the Kindle web reader, and I was just sitting at my computer. I had a full-blown keyboard and stuff. I had a Notepad++, just a simple text editor, at hand, and I took, frankly, a stupid amount of notes on this book.
Yeah, I basically did the same thing. So the first time when I was, you know, telling you about the book as I read it, I kind of summarized each chapter and then just talked about, you know, different my different takes on it. What I thought about each chapter, just to kind of give an overview to you, like kind of what it was about, to see if it'd be something interesting that you would want to read. So, and then that time I read it essentially from cover to cover, like you would read any book. But this time around, I think it was in maybe chapter 3 where he's basically like telling us, hey, just skip around, just read whatever you want to read, not only in the Marvel Universe, which we'll get to, but also in the book itself.
Yeah.
So this time that's what I did. I read the first three chapters because it, you know, it's kind of telling us about the book. And then I went back to the appendix, which we'll get into, but that's kind of what I thought the actual book was going to be about.
Fair enough, yeah.
Then I came back this time. So that was like 1, 2, 3, then the appendix at the end of the book. And then he had these interludes throughout. So I went back and I started reading the interludes because I knew they kind of gave some good history. And then later on, there were some others that were not quite as important. And then I started going through the characters like in you know, that I was interested in. So I started out like I did the Fantastic Four chapter because, of course, that made sense based on his premise. Then I did Spider-Man. So and then X-Men, then Thor, and then kind of on in that direction.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the write up you gave me last year on the structure of the book was just really well done. I really appreciated that. And I think you did a terrific job on that. Now, for the listeners, just again, kind of recapping what you just said, there's three chapters that are all just kind of preamble of what is Marvel, how to get into it, and, you know, what's the book, what isn't the book, that sort of a thing. And then from chapters 4 through 20, it's pretty much all the even chapters are featuring a character or team. So Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Master of Kung Fu, X-Men, Thor and Loki, Black Panther, Dark Reign, which, yeah, we'll get to that. He then had one on Hickman's Avengers run, kind of leading into the Secret Wars stuff, and then one on the Kamala Khan, Ms. Marvel, and Squirrel Girl. And the odd chapters between all of those were those interludes you were mentioning, where he's talking about, you know, the monster era that predated the superhero stuff at Marvel, or
right.
Stanley, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, or the Vietnam years, or music in the Marvel Universe, which, okay, he's a music reviewer, fine, whatever, that's indulgent. Movies before the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which that chapter, these interludes, by the way, were only like 6-7 pages sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Even that felt long for that because it was all the failed Marvel movies pretty much as a bullet point list and then movies mentioned in the comics. And I'm like, why do I care?
Right.
another interlude on presidents, how everyone from JFK to Obama showed up, and kind of mentioned the sliding timeline and how that played in there. He did some stuff on how in March 1965, Marvel kind of invented cross-continuity and the shared universe stuff. And I may have put words in his mouth there. I need to double-check that. But he was talking all about that and seems to credit Marvel with that as an idea. And then Chapter 19, the interlude on Linda Carter, that one just blew me away.
Yeah, that's a big reveal that we probably should spend a little time on.
We're definitely going to have to talk on that. And then he's got, you know, Chapter 21, which I was expecting to be a little bit of an end cap of the Marvel Universe and pulling it all together and stuff. And it really felt like it more should have been almost an afterword or something like that, because it was all his journey reading this with his son.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm right. Sure that was a great opportunity for Douglas Walk and his son Sterling to really bond and all that stuff. I think that's awesome. I envy both of them that. I never really had that kind of experience with my dad. But it didn't tie the book together. And then that appendix you were talking about, where it's just kind of summarizing all the Marvel comics into the various eras and such, that was more what I was expecting the book to be, but I also thought it was kind of surface level.
Right.
And you'll note, in all the characters we talked about that got their own chapters, we don't have one on the Avengers. We don't have one on Captain America. We don't have one on Iron Man.
And even the Defenders aren't there.
Yeah, the Defenders aren't there. I think they're mentioned in passing a time or two, as like they existed. But we don't have really much of anything on the various young heroes of different eras, from the New Mutants to the New Warriors to the Champions and stuff like that. We don't have the original Champion team mentioned. There's so much of the Marvel Universe that doesn't even get mentioned here that I thought it was odd to spend so much time on characters like the Kamala Khan, Ms. Marvel, which I think is a great character. Squirrel Girl, which I read, I think, almost all of that. It was a good character, but neither of those are kind of cornerstones of the Marvel Universe versus, say, Hulk, Iron Man, Captain America, etc. You know, and then again, an entire chapter on the Master of Kung Fu series.
And that was early on, too, so it kind of threw me off when I got to that chapter. That's not what I was expecting.
And I think there's a lot to talk about in those just first three chapters where he's kind of positioning the book before we even get into the meat and potatoes of kind of what he thought of individual comics and whatnot. But those other chapters focusing on the individual characters or titles or story arcs are broken into subsections for particular issues. So being the data guy that I am, you know, I pulled up an Excel spreadsheet. I popped those in there. I put in what year they were from, what decade they were from. Most chapters had anywhere from 15 to 25 individual comics that were kind of called out and such. In most cases, in a haphazard, almost random order. You know, it got to a point where I was putting in a column of kind of why I think he pulled the issue out. And for the Fantastic Four, a lot of those kind of made sense. For some of the others, it's like either I couldn't figure it out or I couldn't articulate it. Or later in the book, I just didn't care anymore. But I then took this list and said, okay, let's do a histogram by year. And I would have figured if a book is covering the Marvel Universe, you're going to have a lot of stuff from the 60s. Because that's the foundational era of the Marvel Universe.
Right.
And if you cover the 60s, we get a total of 21 comics.
Yeah, that's quite a low number. Especially when he keeps going back over and over saying, this is when the Marvel Age of Comics started. This is when the Marvel Universe began.
There is an 8-year period from 2009 to 2016 where over 2/3 of the comics he calls out specifically, that's where they all came from.
Mm-hmm.
And since he's ostensibly stopping at 2017, he says, definitely there's a recency bias. And it's also kind of funny because he says he stops at 2017. He admits he read some stuff after that. But there's a decent percentage, I think about a dozen of them and stuff, were from after 2017.
Yeah, I think I even saw a 2019 one at some point.
There's a 2020 book in there, too.
Yeah. So I guess my assumption is that he had a start point and an end point.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided Fantastic Four number one, you know, when Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, you know, kind of got together and started formulating what we know as now the Marvel Universe and started there. So that perfectly makes sense. And I guess where he ended in 2017, maybe that was where he felt like he wanted to find some kind of ending point, some kind of off ramp. And I guess he just picked Marvel Legacy number one to end it in 2017. But you're right, though. He does go beyond that. Like, even though those were the time frame that he picked, but he definitely went beyond that in terms of, and he didn't just read them. He added those into the book as well.
Yeah. And you've got to have an endpoint. I get it, because otherwise you never publish the book. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's going to be, for the most part, an arbitrary endpoint. I think there was a more logical one for him to pick that would have fit more into his overall premise of the Marvel universe, that shared universe, that shared narrative. He's treating it, and really harps on this point a number of times, as a single story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because he referred to it as, and this is where having this many notes is problematic, a continuous self-contained work of fiction, and that it's the largest of its type. And it's like, I don't agree that it's a single story with any definition of story. Now, granted, he never gives his definition of story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you want to go with a shared universe, it's certainly that. Is it the largest one ever? That I don't know about. It depends how you define largest. And of course, we've talked about this before we recorded and stuff, that, well, is the DC universe. And he admits the DC universe is out there. But it's like, oh yeah, that was rebooted in 1986. It's like, well, it kind of was and kind of wasn't. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that carried over. The characters remember before and after. So it's not like it's a clean slate and everything was stopped. Same with the new 52 reboot.
Right.
Both of those took the history of the DC universe into a blender, messed it up, and you could argue if it ever recovered or not. But it is no more a disconnect in the story than, say, the more recent Secret Wars stuff in 2015. So to just discard DC, there were a number of things where he either made claims I felt were insubstantiated or was very dismissive of certain things, more so than I felt were warranted.
Well, going back to the DC Comics thing, I kind of want to read his quote, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
So he talks about how, you know, the Marvel story is not the first or the only one. DC Comics, which is Marvel's largest competitor, and other comics have adopted the universe template too, but it's the largest of its kind. And then it drops down to the notes, which are at the bottom, which I know are hard to read on the Kindle, but in this case, you just look straight down.
On the Kindle itself, it was fine. It was on the web reader, it was a pain.
Oh, okay.
But yeah.
The web reader.
Sorry.
That's okay, but it says, that's part of why this book is about Marvel rather than DC or some other shared universe. For all the superhero comics that DC has published since 1938, it was very slow to integrate them into anything like a coherent fictional world. And that world was rebooted in 1986. And of course, that's Crisis on Infinite Earths. Mm-hmm. And again in 2011, discarding most of its established history. But I don't feel like they were slow to do that. You know, you had things like the Justice Society of America, where they're literally crossing over in the same issue. You have Brave and the Bold. You have World's Finest. You know, you have all of these where, you know, they all exist in the same universe and they are crossing over in the Golden Age.
Well, Brave and the Bold doesn't go as far back as the Golden Age, so we can't really count that.
Right.
World's Finest, there was a long period of time where Batman and Superman were both on the covers, but not in the same stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know when they first got into the same story. But the Justice Society of America has been around since 1940.
Right.
So to say that DC wasn't doing a shared universe, I think is just blatantly incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
And to say it was slow to pick it up, I don't think it was all that slow. Now, it's interesting, though, because, again, he's equating all of that shared universe stuff as a Marvel thing in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he's also completely ignoring the past of the Marvel Universe, because as you go as far back as Marvel Mystery Comics number 8, and you've got the Submariner fighting the original Human Torch.
Mm-hmm.
So, shared universe at that point. Now, I'm not going to be claim to be any kind of trivia expert or whatnot on the Marvel Universe, or honestly the DC for that matter, but that sure seems like a shared continuity at both companies back 20 years before he says the Marvel saga really began.
Mm-hmm.
So I think using Fantastic Four as a starting point, I mean, it makes sense. I think certainly the seeds of what would become the Marvel Universe as we know it today, obviously major aspects predate the 60s, but that was when it kind of became what we know it to be today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's when we get the Founding Fathers. That's when we get so many of the main pillars of the continuity and such, and they've pulled in so much of what they'd published before.
Yeah, there was this explosion of characters that happened beginning with Fantastic Four and then just going on to the Avengers, Spider-Man, X-Men, you know, and it was just like one hit after the next. So I think Fantastic Four is a great starting point, and it makes sense to start there in the sense of that's when things kind of changed.
I agree with that. I think it's ironic in the Fantastic Four chapter, he did not start there.
Right.
And then he's got that whole other chapter saying, oh, but really, I like to think that the beginning is this other place.
Yeah.
So, well, which is it? Is it Fantastic Four or is it not? And I felt there were a number of times he was trying to have his cake and eat it too, or just try to hold two mutually exclusive positions at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, that was just kind of weird. You know, and again, ending at Marvel Legacy number one in 2017, you got to pick something, but you figure the book was published in 2021, step it back a year or two for getting the final draft put together, edited, it's got to get printed, all that stuff. He could have read at least into 2019, and there is a quote from page 304 of, now it's changing again, of the 85 new Marvel issues cover dated March 2020. Okay, so he was still working on it right around the time the COVID pandemic was beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So he could have gone a good couple of years further than 2017. Now, I don't think he was under any obligation to do so. I don't know that that would have improved or really changed the meat and potatoes of the book at all. If anything, I would have suggested he roll it back to around July 2015, which is when that Secret Wars started. Because a couple of times, I mean, he has a quote from the first issue of the Marvel Universe, 1961 to 2015, you know, as in it's dead at that point.
Right.
But if you're saying it ran continuously and unbroken from, you know, 1961 to the present day, and 2015's not the present day, that doesn't make sense. And then further on page 311, when he's talking about Ms. Marvel number 19, which is part of that whole mess, he's like, Marvel's entire line of comics ended and started again as a result of Secret Wars.
Right.
He's got another quote of earlier phase shifts within the Marvel story have all come about accidentally and are evident only in retrospect. The one that happens in 2015 is deliberate, obvious, and coordinated. Every narrative strand is tied off or severed. Every series concludes. The universe ends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're saying the universe ended, again, how is it a continuous narrative that goes past that?
Right. And that makes sense that that would be an ending point to that narrative instead of continuing on to 2017 or beyond.
As good as any, better than any other, I would think. But yeah. And he goes into a lot of this in the chapter where he's talking about his three rules for inclusion of what did he read.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I found this interesting because I don't know that I would have used, well, I know I would not have used these exact rules, but, you know, I gave some thought as to what I would use. And his first was it a comic book published by Marvel during the period bounded by 1961's Fantastic Four number one and 2017's Marvel Legacy number one? Okay, Fantastic Four number one, a decent starting point. There's stuff prior to that that certainly is in continuity, but okay. And you got to pick an end point, so whether that was the right one or not, who cares? He picked it, fine. That, to me, is a concrete rule. I think he's missing out on at least 20 years of continuity, but okay.
You mean pre-1961, then?
Pre-1961.
Yeah.
Everything with the original Captain America stuff, Namor, the Human Torch, what became the Agents of Atlas. There is
right.
So much stuff from that period that's been pulled into continuity. Now, whether you consider it pulled in or whatever, tomato, tomato. Starting with Fantastic Four, I think, is a symbolic starting point, as long as you acknowledge that the continuity didn't start there, but that was that ignition spark, if you will, kind of that big bang of creativity that pulled it all together into what it became.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
His second rule, did it involve characters owned by Marvel? This is a reasonably concrete inclusion-exclusion rule if you take it literally as involved characters owned by, and don't take it as only involves characters owned by.
Mm-hmm.
Because he says it excludes Star Wars, G.I. Joe, Conan the Barbarian, etc. But properties that did cross over the Marvel Universe, he claims to, quote, have read them all. Master of Kung Fu, Rom, Godzilla, Micronauts, etc.
Mm-hmm.
This, to me, is an understandable rule, but a little fuzzy. Because I remember reading something off the rack in the mid-80s. I don't remember if it was Transformers. It must have been Transformers, not G.I. Joe, although they had both licenses at the time. And Spider-Man was in there.
Right, you know? Yeah.
So at what point do things connect, not connect? And again, he's using the cutoff point of 2017. I don't remember exactly when Marvel got the Conan license back and pulled him into the universe proper.
I think it was January of 2019.
That sounds yeah, reasonable.
And they immediately integrated him there.
And there was one issue of What If that Conan the Barbarian's in.
Right.
But, okay, that was What If was a series published by Marvel. It involved characters owned by Marvel. So did he read it? Did he not? I don't know.
Yeah, that's one series he didn't mention at all was What If, which had some...
He did. He mentioned it twice.
He did, okay.
And the reason that stood out to me, those were the only places he mentioned Mark Gruenwald.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Mark Gruenwald, for those who don't know, was a writer, an editor. He was in charge of continuity at Marvel at one point. He was an artist, although he didn't do a whole lot of art. He did the Hawkeye series from 1984, 85. Did fine on that. Anyways, the way it's phrased in one of the footnotes is he dabbled with art kind of a thing, like he was trying to do something he wasn't qualified for. Mark Gruenwald's claims to fame are an extended run on Captain America. It just went on forever and a day. He wrote the highly acclaimed Squadron Supreme series from 1985-ish, and he was one of the main movers and shakers behind the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. How you can get through a book on the Marvel Universe without referencing that once? I don't know, but Walk managed to do it.
The other question I wanted to bring up was the 27,000 number. And I know you had tried to do some...
But before we get to that, let's get to the third rule, because that leads
yes,
directly
right.
to
Sorry.
It.
Oh, yes, right. Sorry, yes. That's true.
His third and final rule was, could the version of Spider-Man who stars in The Amazing Spider-Man reasonably turn up in it without the benefit of time travel or not, whether he does or not? And I'm like, well, that's a very subjective rule. I mean, in the MC2 imprint, he shows up there without time travel. He's just older. Alternate future, does he count that or not?
Mm-hmm.
The original Guardians of the Galaxy are clearly part of the overall Marvel narrative. I mean, there were Avengers at one point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's set in the future, so did he not read those? Now, excluding like the Marvel Age imprint for young readers, you know, MC2 and some of the other stuff, okay, that makes sense, I get it. He kind of grandfathered in the Ultimate Comics stuff because it dovetailed into the Marvel Universe, so he read all 600-plus of those. The 1985 Squadron Supreme series. Did he read that or not? I don't know. Spider-Man never showed up in it. It was another universe, but that miniseries crossed over with the Captain America title at the time, so those characters have shown up in the Marvel Universe enough times. To me, it's part of that overall continuity. But this one rule allowed him to ignore Westerns, war titles, all kinds of stuff like that. But that cuts out the backstory of Nick Fury and a couple of Avengers like the Two-Gun Kid and Red Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
So, this to me was really fuzzy, and I felt he really should have included a list of what was in his master list as an appendix or something like that, or at the very least, publish it on his website. I mean, did he read the new universe or not? It's outside the mainstream Marvel universe, but at one point, Quasar was powered by the Star Brand from it.
Right.
Blur from that universe showed up in the Squadron Supreme in the mainstream Marvel universe. It's... To me, this was such a nebulous rule to be a little frustrating.
And right after the three rules, he brings up that, you know, he basically skipped the Western and war comics, but he did read the Marvel's post-1958 horror and romance anthologies.
Yes, and the romance stuff is interesting because there was a comment he made, I think it was as a footnote, it was around page 11, quote, "The only significant Marvel character who's been on Earth at the same time as Spider-Man without yet encountering him face-to-face is Millie Collins, whose sitcom series Millie the Model ran 207 issues ending in 1973, and Spider-Man's ex, Mary Jane Watson, has worked with Millie," unquote. Okay, I don't know when Mary Jane worked with Millie or not. I saw that, and I'm like, the only significant Marvel character, ...
Right.
Millie the Model. Now, either he read Millie the Model or he did not. 207 issues. Out of what he later says is 27,206 total. This is getting close to a percentage. It's like 0.7% of that total reading-ish, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a meaningful number. And I'm like, I don't know that she's really in the Marvel Universe. I certainly don't think she's a significant character. To back that up, I did some digging. She was not in the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, the original version. She was not in the deluxe edition. It took until the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, The Women of Marvel, in 2005, which is, what, 20 years after the handbook had been being published on and off for that long, for her to be included. Now, I had originally found it in the trade. It was in that one particular thing. In the trades, there's also an entry for Night Nurse, which is a character we're definitely going to be talking about. And it flat out states in that Marvel Universe entry, quote, "It remains uncertain whether the Night Nurse is connected to the two other nurses named Linda Carter, both of whom trained at New York City's Metropolitan General Hospital," unquote. He later states categorically it is the same.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, that could have been established after around 2008 when this entry was published. Certainly possible. But I would have approached the question of scope probably from a different direction. I would have either started at Fantastic Four or somewhere in the thick of the Marvel Universe. Say, okay, this is my starting point. I'm reading this title. Read that title moving forward. And as other publications are kind of pulled into that continuity, again, presumably the one started in Fantastic Four and stuff, add those titles to the reading list.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it mentions, you know, Spider-Man. Boom, Spider-Man's now on the list. Oh, it mentions Nick Fury. Let's pull that in. As you read those other things, it's a recursive kind of a process. You read those titles, they reference other stuff, you pull those in. And you grow the continuity that way. Now, again, you still got to pick some arbitrary endpoint as you want to get the book done. But I also probably would have gone about this a little differently than he did, of just kind of bouncing around haphazardly through the Marvel Universe. I'd have tried to start closer to the beginning and move forward from there. Possibly month by month, depending how organized I was, it may just be on arc by arc or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he does make a comment in a footnote that his spreadsheet claims, again, there are exactly 27,206 comics, but he doesn't entirely trust that spreadsheet. And it's like, I'd love to see this list.
Right.
Now, for comparison, I've got well over 25,000 comics from Marvel in my collection. Now, obviously not all of these would fall into the criteria. It's, you know, Star Wars stuff and various things like that that clearly should not fall into the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't have a ton of Marvels, say, before the mid-1970s, but I don't know how many of what I've got and what is in his 27,000-plus list, what kind of overlap there is. And again, not in the book, not on his website. I did a web search. I finally found a contact page on his website, and I specifically asked, could I get a copy of the list of the 27,000-plus comics that Douglas read for all of the Marvels?
Mm-hmm.
And I got a reply, and actually fairly quick, which I appreciate. And the reply, understandably brief, because I mean, I'm sure he's a busy guy. Quote, "I used the incredibly helpful Marvel Master List at mikesamazingworld.com, and he gives the URL. Then I cut it down with the guidelines I mentioned in the book. That list also includes separate entities for each variant cover, collected edition, etc. And I only officially obligated myself to read the comics set in 616 and in the present day in quotes, published between 1961 and 2017, though I read a bunch of others too," end quote. Now, I downloaded the file, and it indeed did have all the variant covers, collected editions, etc. It was a list of over 77,000 items.
Now, did they count the individual, like the ones that had the variant covers, were those counted as an individual issues?
Yep.
Oh, okay. So if a comic had 10 covers, that was counted as 10 issues on that list?
Yep.
Oh, that's confusing.
Well, and it boiled out as to what the covers are and stuff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest, I didn't spend a ton of time in there. When I saw it had 77,000, and I'm like, what was the 27,000 out of that you read? Literally, I would be filtering out 2/3 of the list. And there's a part of me, given he flat out said he's got a spreadsheet, I've got this list.
Mm-hmm.
Is it 100% accurate? Errors are going to get made, particularly in a list that size. Fine, there's a little fudge factor and stuff there. But to not kind of show your work,
right,
didn't really sit particularly well with me, because there's another thing in here where on his reading, he mentions again bouncing around and stuff like that, how he sourced all the stuff. And I know I found an article, I think it was on the Nerdist, that he spent like 5 years doing all this reading. That's a lot of comics to do in 5 years.
27,000 comics in 5 years.
I did some math, and let's say, okay, 5 years exactly. Let's give him 2 weeks off a year, because, I mean, we're not taskmasters. We're kind, benevolent individuals. So 50 weeks a year, 5 days a week, you can have weekends off. That's 21, 22 comics a day. That's doable. But that's every weekday for every quote unquote work week for 5 years. That's a lot.
That's quite the grind right there. Goodness.
And he had another interview he gave where he was talking about reading the Punisher stuff, because he had put that off to the end. And I'm not going to judge that decision. You're going to put something off. I get it. That's not his cup of tea. That's fine. I'm not going to say it's my cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he locked himself in an apartment for 11 days with a bunch of power drinks or, you know, whatever, and read all the Punisher comics. Well, I took that same basic list, filtered for Punisher in the title, figuring that'll give me a decent list, took out the Max, the Epic, the trades, the hardcovers, any title which extended into 2017, and I got 830 comics. 11 days.
That's a lot.
That's 75 comics a day. That is doable, but that's going to take a toll.
Mm-hmm. Especially considering that is a character he didn't want to read.
Yes, yes.
That's a lot to consume like that.
Yeah, that's a deep dive in short order for something he freely admitted putting off. And again, I do not judge him on that. I'm the kind of guy who, when I was in college, I had a 2-year foreign language requirement for my degree. So I waited until I was 2 years from graduating. It's like, yeah, I guess I'm actually possibly going to get this degree. I better go start on that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I get it. I get it. But just to put that 27,000 comics into context, I use drawer boxes, and those hold on average, based on my numbers and stuff, about 212-ish. So it would take 127 plus drawer boxes, which is a little off from a long box dimension, to do that. So if you stacked those 6 high, you'd need 21 columns of those. That would take up over 16.5 feet wide, a little over 2 feet deep, and about 6.5 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
That is a staggering amount of comics. Now, obviously, he didn't read them all physically. He borrowed copies, he read trades, hardcovers, a ton digitally, some in essentials, you know, stuff like that. And these days, I think it's easier to source these things than it would have been certainly 20 years ago.
You mean source where he read them from? Or?
Yeah, well, like the Marvel app and stuff is going to have a lot of them. But I don't know if I would have used, I certainly don't think I would have used the same criteria he did. His criteria was fuzzy. Is 27,000 the totality of the Marvel Universe? I'm going to go out on a little bit of a ledge and say absolutely not. I think he cut out stuff because it didn't fall into the 1961 to 2017 range. That is very clearly key parts of the Marvel continuity, and also probably did not include things that may seem tangential but become relevant parts of the Marvel Universe when those characters get pulled into something like a Spider-Verse or, you know, otherwise cross over into the mainstream Marvel Universe.
I wanted to go. So when you filtered that list, you got rid of the variant covers and all that. What was the final number that you came out to trying to estimate that list from that time period?
I didn't even get close enough to that to come up with a reasonable number.
Okay.
Because again, it's not something where you can take his 3 rules and just click a couple of buttons.
Yeah, it's a manual thing.
Because you got to kick out all the Star Wars stuff. You know, again, the judgment call of which properties do I include Micronauts and ROM, but not G.I. Joe, or maybe Transformers and all that kind of a stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just if, based on the list, you can recognize what are Marvel-owned properties and what are not. And that's a lot of why I think he should have published his list.
So with the Mike's Amazing World, did it have them in chronological order? Like, so you could formulate a list that you could, like, if you say you wanted to read, you know, and I think that's a great idea, right? You start with Fantastic Four and you go in chronological order based on when the comic was released, which, you know, they have that data on Mike's Amazing World as best as we have knowledge, like when it hit the newsstands.
It has a month, a year, and a date. And as to how accurate those are, I don't know. And then you can sort it however you want to kind of filter some stuff down that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I had gotten to where I had filtered out anything that was a hardcover, softcover, or trade paperback, because they put that inexplicably in the number column. I filtered out anything that was an imprint. So that was Baby with the Bathwater. I don't think it should have included anything. But that right there only got me down to, because again, all the variants and stuff, 31,221.
Uh-huh.
And no, there was a variant column, and I filtered that out too. So I did filter out the variants. But then I've got, well, what I didn't filter out was based on the year. So okay. I still got stuff like the funny animals, you know, Ziggy Pig, Silly Seal comics and such.
Mm-hmm.
So if I filter down by the year, and he started in 1961, so we will include all of 1961. That gets it down to, I must be doing something wrong, because I was giving a sum, not a count, I'm sorry. I'm at 39,615 items.
Okay.
Not all of which should be included. Adventures of Snake Plissken obviously should not be included. This mm-hmm. is where it becomes a manual. Do I want to go through, you know, this much to, again, whittle it down by, at this point, about a quarter to get down to what he might have had as his list? And if you're going to make this claim that it's the biggest story ever told and I've read it all and stuff, I think it's a reasonable expectation for him to, you know, again, show a little of his work.
The part that I wanted to go into was on page 12 when he gives us a number. So we're expecting, you know, this giant sum, 27,000 comics. And then I was actually shocked the first time I read this. And once again, I had different expectations going in. I was thinking appendix style, right? Beginning to present. And when he said on page 12, I didn't read them in order, of course, that would have been unbearable. Instead, I grazed. And so he talks about bouncing from, you know, I think three or four titles here. So he's like modern age and then, you know, back to, he didn't say when these comics are, but maybe late golden age or late early silver age with Fing Fang Foom and then a bunch of early 70s romance comics. And so I guess for me, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you. So I don't think that would help me formulate any kind of a narrative if I'm just bouncing around.
I agree with that entirely. And this is something I struggle with all the time when I do either with the book club or back issue spotlights. And it's, okay, let's go read a comic from 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah. And everybody asks you, they're like, hey, John, so what was going on with these other characters during this time period, you know?
We did that with, like, the Lightning Saga, and that was from, what, 2007-ish, give or take?
Right.
And it was crossing over between Justice League and Justice Society, pulling in all the subplots of what was happening then at the time. And I read that stuff back in the day, off the rack, loved it, and at that point I could have answered those questions.
Mm-hmm.
20 years removed from that continuity, it's like, oh, they're saying something about, you know, Red Tornado being alive as a human or whatever. It's like, I guess he was for a few minutes. I think, and this is one of the big failings I think this book had, is he sets himself up as, I have read this all, I understand it, and let me share that wisdom with you. Not in those exact words, but there are a number of quotes that are very much to that point. And I never felt I got out of this book that kind of view from above
mm-hmm.
of, yeah, in the moment it looked this way, but if you look at the totality of it, you see how these fit together, or this contradicted, or this is that way, or whatever.
And that's kind of what I was expecting, right? Was he was going to keep pulling back and saying, oh, so this is how I thought it was going to be this big revelation of how everything just connected perfectly and made this story that made sense.
Yeah. Well, again, if you're claiming it's one singular narrative, which I do not buy lock, stock, and barrel at all. I mean, just again, how can you consider 27,000 plus comics a self-contained narrative? It's just oxymoronic on the face of it. There is another book, Marvel Year by Year, that I'm only, I don't know, 7, 8, maybe 10% of the way through. And it's going year by year, starting back at the dawn of what became Marvel back in 1939, I think it was. And I'm only up to about 1953. And it's giving me a lot more of what I was expecting out of this. It also had some people a lot more kind of in the know. I mean, Tom DeFalco was one of the guys on that book.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, and here, if you've really read all of the stuff and could piece it together like he claims to have done, then I think we should have seen evidence of that in the book. And I think bouncing around the way he did, which is an understandable reading strategy, but, and I'll just take it on faith, he read all 27,000 of these things. Again, I don't see evidence of that in the book, but I'm not going to say he didn't do it. I think, though, he read it for entertainment, not for research or writing. And I know when I read a comic just to read it, I go through, it's like I read the story, I get the story, I move on. And admittedly, sometimes I've had in the past where I used to have, you know, big stacks I would get every week. I'd take them out of one stack,
mm-hmm.
unbag it, unboard it, read it, bag it, board it, flip it over, move on to the next. And by the time I've pulled the other one out, I'm like, what did I just read?
Right.
It was a street level character. Was it Marvel? Was it DC? Was it Batman? Was it Derek? You know, and it's just...
Uh-huh.
Because it's read for entertainment, in one eye, out the other, almost. for this kind of a book, for the kinds of claims Walk continually makes in this, I felt he should have at least taken notes. If he had taken, and I'm not saying he didn't take any, but I didn't see evidence of him really piecing the puzzle of the Marvel Universe together the way he kind of claims to have done. And I think reading it in that haphazard order, while understandable, it really beefs up the I've got to be checking off what I've read and stuff aspect of it. And again, trying to put the continuity together, if you're going from a 2000s era Avengers to a, you know, 1970s era, you know, Power Man and issue or something like that, you're going to have a hell of a time putting the continuity together. And there were a couple of places I caught some flat out errors in the book. And no book is going to be perfect. No book is going to be 100% error free or whatever.
Right.
But there were a couple of these that I'm reading it and I trip over the sentence. It's like that's just not right. You know.
I think, you know, I agree with you. Like I think, and I think there was a part later on where he talked about like the three chronologies. So I want to get to that at some point too.
Yeah, I do want to talk about those. I thought those were interesting.
But in this case, like exactly, like you're reading for, if you're reading for entertainment purposes, you know, you're reading whatever you're interested in at the time. Like you're reading, like I'm reading the current Moon Knight series. A few years ago, I was reading Conan. So you're reading what you're interested in. But when you're doing a book like this, it does make sense to, and especially if you're formulating it in the idea that, hey, the Marvel Universe began forming, and as we know it today, began forming in 1961. And then like chronologically to explore that in not real time, but for him, explore that in that time period as it developed.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have helped a point like, is there an actual story or not? And I think that would have done a little bit better.
Like for the Fantastic Four chapter, if I had written something like that, I probably would have tried to say it started in 1961. We're going up to whatever point we're going up to. Okay, fine. 2017 and Marvel Legacy. That's it. What are the eras, if you will, of that property? You know, you've got the foundational building of the core mythology, you know, with the Lee Kirby stuff early on. You've got way further down, you've got like the John Byrne era. You've got a brief point where you've got the new Fantastic Four. You've got the period where She-Hulk filled in. You've got the period where the membership changed to include Black Panther and Storm and such, or this creative team shifted, or it was telling this kind of story or whatever. But something to where you can basically be segmenting that timeline and saying, if you're really into this kind of a story, this is for you. If you want this, maybe this time's for you or something like that. And we so did not get that.
Right. And then that way you get a whole overview of a team book, right? Or like in this case, a Fantastic Four. You get to see like, okay, let me see what different eras are. Okay, yeah, I definitely want to check out this particular era, you know?
Well, in the Fantastic Four, he calls out 15 comics, three of which are not even Fantastic Four issues.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were interesting picks. He included Power Pack number 16. That is when Franklin first met Power Pack. And I'm like, man, what a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You have two of just about the only families of superheroes in the Marvel Universe at that point. And the difference is all the adults have it in the Richards family, essentially. All the kids have it in the Powers family and such. And you've got one guy who's kind of in between. And there's such a compare and contrast that could have been done. But we don't get that. We just get, oh, he needed friends and this is who they were. And again, if you've read all of this, if you've pieced all this together and stuff, which is by no means a simplistic task in any way, shape, or form.
Right. This is a huge time-consuming and monumental project that he was working on.
Absolutely. But I feel he went through the exercise of reading everything casually and then writing a book as if he's an expert.
That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you, John. So if you were to do a history of the Marvel Universe in the sense that you're trying to formulate an overall story, like how would you go about doing it?
Well, it's funny because I'm struggling with that very question on the Legion Spotlight episodes I do.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to do something, because that's only like 1,600 comics versus, again, 27,000-ish or whatever the real number would be, depending on your criteria for the Marvel Universe.
Mm-hmm.
I would not go into that without having done a serious game plan, which I made a point of not putting a game plan together for the Legion Spotlight because I felt if I did, I'd never start the damn thing. But it would involve taking notes, piecing things together, trying to, it's like, oh, this, because like when he pulls in Doctor Strange number 53 and West Coast Avengers 22, where other teams go back and encounter Rama Tut at the same time Fantastic Four did in number 19. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was kind of interesting. You tie those things together. It's like, how do all of these comics interconnect story-wise, character-wise, etc.? I mean, to me, there's like a graph database to be had on all of this. And I don't expect your average reader to be able to put something like that together or even want to put something like that together.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you've got the memory of a Mark Waid, a Tom Brevoort, a Mark Gruenwald, or a select handful of people, and maybe Douglas Walk has that kind of memory. Again, didn't see evidence of that in the book.
Well, even when he's talking about it in the Doctor Strange 53, he said it's quote, it's worth noting that Stern wrote this issue for an audience he knew would almost certainly not have read or even have access to the Lee and Kirby comic, which had been reprinted 8 years earlier. So you're talking 1982. So there's no internet, and you wouldn't necessarily, you know that you could connect that piece. So in the way that comic readers would turn over, like if you were a kid in 1963 and you were no longer reading in 82, or if you were new as a kid reading it in 1982, you would not probably have access to that.
Well, I think at some point he made reference, probably in a footnote, because there is a ton of stuff in his footnotes. But he made a reference to it being somewhere in the 2000s when everything started getting collected in trades.
Mm-hmm.
So really, there are, I'm going to say, maybe four eras of reading in one way to slice it. One, what you find on the spinner rack is all you ever see. Two, the direct market has come into being. There are now back issue shops. You can
right.
find things if you're lucky and you'll look. Three, you now have trade paperbacks becoming a bit more ubiquitous or existing at all, actually. And you can go read some stuff there if you missed it on the spinner rack or what have you. And then the current age where you've got the digital service, where if you want to go check something, it's much easier to get access to it now of just, oh, you know, let's pull up the Marvel app, click, click, boom.
Mm-hmm.
Here's this Spider-Man annual he's talking about or something.
And we're also at a time where, and that, I think he mentions this at some point in the book, where every single story arc, every single series, they just collect five or six issues and they put it in a volume, and mm-hmm. that's your trade.
I'm pretty sure he mentioned that started somewhere in the mid-2000s. It's like, dude, mm-hmm. you're, again, doing a whole book on this. Take the time to go find out exactly when they did that.
Right.
You know, there were times where I felt there was a little bit more research he could have and really should have done, and he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I can easily see the defense being, well, he read 27,000 comics. Yeah, but when you toss some comments out there of this may or may not be the case, I'm like, well, if you don't know, why mention it?
Mm-hmm.
A little frustrating.
One of the resources that I found fairly recently is called marvelreading.com, and they have it broken down by titles, characters. So if you want to read like a specific character, so it's called the Complete Marvel Reading Order. And there is one, if you just click it, it's called The Order. And once again, I'm not 100% sure how accurate it is, but essentially, it starts at Fantastic Four number one, then Fantastic Four number two, and then it jumps over to Tales to Astonish, back to Fantastic Four, and then you go to Incredible Hulk, and then as the other ones get added, like Journey into Mystery, like it throws mm-hmm. those in chronological order. And so I think for me, like if I were to do something like this, if I was trying to go back and say, hey, it started in 1961, let me see if I can formulate a story. I think there's two options. One is you literally just read it as it happened, you know, in terms of release.
Which Walk flat out says, do not do a couple of times.
Right. He explicitly says, don't do that. And then the other one would just be, hey, I want to see how the Fantastic Four developed over the last, you know, 60, 70 years, right? I want to see how they developed. And so you would just read that title and every iteration of that title until you were complete. And then you could formulate a story about those characters, right? And then you would take another character, you know, Incredible Hulk, and then start from his first appearance and just work your way up, kind of like you're doing with the Legion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that for me, that makes the most sense in terms of if I'm trying to formulate a narrative that this is the overall story, I think that would be the best way to start.
Yeah, if you're trying to build up the context, I think you have to do it that way because the amount of work to do it any other way is, I think, prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you've got perfect photographic memory, just to kind of mentally sort the stuff into a semblance of order isn't going to work. Particularly when you're talking, again, 27,000 comics. I mean, I would have started with kind of the foundational cornerstone titles of the Marvel Universe. Fantastic Four, Amazing Spider-Man, X-Men, Avengers, Hulk, Thor, with the actual titles they started, with those properties.
Right, right.
I probably would have started by using the Fireside Trades that came out in the 70s. Origins, Son of Origins, Bring on the Bad Guys, the Superhero Woman and stuff is kind of a blueprint of where to start, and then kind of flesh it out from there. I probably also would have used the Marvel Comics in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, all those things as guides.
Mm-hmm.
But then also try to create kind of blocks of issues based on creator runs or eras of a title or things to give a coherent narrative with a entry and exit point. Because I don't think it makes sense to read all however many hundreds of Fantastic Four and then go into Spider-Man and try to weave that into the continuity. I also don't think it makes sense to go necessarily, even if you had all the data, which I think might be gettable, of here's the actual weeks they came out and just treat it as if that's what you got that week off the spinner rack.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, you're context switching so much.
Right.
So it's definitely a huge undertaking, and I applaud him for attempting it. But I've seen a few interviews with him, and I feel the success I think he had and the success he thinks he had don't match.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying not to be unduly hard on the guy, because again, it's a big undertaking. But to get through an entire chapter on Spider-Man without mentioning the word symbiote once,
mm-hmm.
kind of interesting. And he does mention Venom and stuff like that, although he's got an error or two on that too.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm not expecting the book to be error-free, to error is human, etc., but there's a point at which you can fact-check a couple of things, you know? And I don't think he had this read by somebody who was a hardcore comic book fan and could have caught some of these things.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I wanted to bring up too, like we're, and I know we're not quite there yet, but the chapter where he's talking about passing it along to his son,
mm-hmm.
I think at some point in there, he talks about where he came up with the idea, you know, with reading these issues with his son that it might be a great idea to read all of them, you know? And so I think this probably happened. And I'm kind of trying to piece that together. I don't know that for a fact, but it feels like he was reading comics with his son, trying to enjoy it. And then he was like, hey, why don't I just read everything? You know, and I think that's kind of how this project started, not necessarily by design.
I agree with that. And it definitely seems like the experience of reading it with his son colored the book significantly.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a point where in that last chapter, he mentioned his son really wasn't interested in the 70s, the 80s, or the 90s. And I suppose it could just be happenstance that there's a period of a couple of years from like 93 to 97 where like only two comics are called out. But the comics from those eras definitely get the short end of the book. Mm-hmm. To the point a couple of times he'll get to a comic in, I think it was like the Thor chapter and maybe one of the others, where it's like, and this happened in 1970-something and nothing important happened for the next 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, damn.
Yeah, no significant developments, right?
Yeah. And I get not every comic is going to be a winner. I certainly agree with that. But to suggest that nothing important or relevant happened to a character at all in a 10 or 15 year period, and to get through an entire chapter on Thor without mentioning Eric Masterson, Thunderstrike, or that whole period and some stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
kind of astonishing.
Yeah, because a lot of people, that is their Thor. You know, they grew up with, and they have a fondness for Eric Masterson.
Yeah. Well, again, there's definite clear eras of Thor. There's the Simonson era.
Mm-hmm.
There's, again, the Thunderstrike Eric Masterson era of stuff. There's the Asgard on Earth era with Straczynski and some things like that. There's some very obvious ways to segment the Thor kind of timeline and such, and to basically get a what felt like a haphazard selection of comics, because he covered like 22 in there, and he placed Loki on even footing as Thor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, Loki certainly has come into his own, certainly in the last 10, 15 years because of the movies and such. But he made a comment at one point on how for the first few decades, Loki was never really seen except once or twice or whatever, a handful of times outside of the Thor book. Obviously, Avengers number one being a very key, you know, counterexample and such.
Mm-hmm.
But to be saying simultaneously that this character of Loki was relegated to the Thor corner of the universe and was a pillar of the overall Marvel universe at the same time, a little weird.
I felt like there was a lot of times where he would say one thing and then basically say the exact opposite about the same situation.
Yep.
So you go back to, you know, where he's talking about Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko. There was a core of creators that this Marvel universe took off with.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says that the reason that the universe came together and I guess made so much sense was the fact that they were all working in concert together.
Yeah, it was a handful of guys and they were talking, yeah.
Yeah. And then in some other ways, he talks about how they're just trying to meet deadlines and they're trying to get books out there. And so I was like, well, which one is it? You know, are they sitting down? Are they doing this thing on purpose? And there's a quote that I'll try to find later, but he essentially says that it wasn't on purpose. And I was like, well, I thought it was by design.
Exactly.
You know, I thought they were coming together and trying to create this, you know, this new world, this world where it's all populated with these superheroes.
It was by design and by accident at the same time. And I'm like, again, which is it?
So I don't know, you know.
There were a number of inconsistencies in the book like that, and I felt that interlude on Stanley, Jack Kirby, and Steve Ditko was interesting. And I think there's a lot of people that have a lot of thoughts on certainly the Stan and Jack relationship.
Right. There's been a lot published on that over the years.
Yeah. And I definitely got the opinion Walk was not Team Stan.
Mm-hmm.
Again, at least twice Stan was referred to as a con artist in this book.
Right.
And that the only character he really created was Stan Lee. And I am not going to suggest by any stretch that Stan Lee was the creative visionary of the Marvel Universe or anything. He was not. It was certainly a team effort. I think Jack Kirby rightly deserves the King of Comics in a way that will arguably never be topped, much like, you know, Elvis Presley is the King of Rock and Roll and nobody's going to top him, because to a degree, both of those guys kind of defined their art forms.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone after them can only redefine it. So what I think that Walk didn't adequately cover here or really cover at all is that Stan Lee was one of the key gravitational forces of the Marvel Universe that helped pull it all together. Now, whether he did that as a creative genius or somebody that people rose to the occasion just to spite him,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. But even all of that in the office creative aspects aside, he was the cheerleader, the champion, and the face of comics for decades.
Mm-hmm. We may not be talking about Marvel Universe, and especially in cinema, right?
In cinema, on cartoons. I mean, if you go back mm-hmm. to, what was it, the 80s or whatever, and there was the Hulk cartoon and Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends and stuff, and you've got, you know, Stan Lee doing some of the voice, the introduction and stuff.
Right.
It humanized it. He was literally the face man of not just Marvel Comics, but all of comics for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you get the Marvel Universe, certainly of the 60s, without him. I don't think you get the original timely comics to a certain degree without him.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm going through that Marvel year-by-year book, and it's pointing out that as a teenager, he was involved with Marvel early on when characters, again, like Captain America and so forth, were being created. Again, not saying he had anything necessarily directly to do with it, but he was in the room, he was involved and stuff, and is part of, as obviously, you know, Kirby and many others were back then too, they're part of the DNA of the Marvel Universe on a deep foundational level.
They are.
So to pass him off as just a con man flabbergasted me.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those that, you know, information has come out over time. You know, like, you know, there have been several books published, mm-hmm. and some from Stan Lee's perspective, some from Jack Kirby's perspective. There have been a few, and I think there was one book from Tomorrow's Publishing. And basically, they just published what the two said about the Marvel Universe and what the two said about each other, and they just kind of let it speak for itself. So I thought that was a really good, I call it middle of the road take, right? And so you give both sides to it. And I think on the other side, you look at the evidence that we have is when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby came together, the universe came alive, right? And they never reached that success.
Yeah, that was the big bang of the Marvel Universe to a large extent, yeah.
Right. And they went their separate ways, and the success was never quite the same. That magic was never quite there as they transitioned to different people, different characters, like not working together. So I definitely think it was a team effort, and the way that they were able to, you know, work together and be so successful in that small, you know, 7 or 8 comics, you know, as they started out, and then they just continue to build from there. So I think it was just a magical time. It was that perfect time, right? Because you basically had Martin Goodman was essentially ready to close the doors because, you know, a lot of the other comics that they were doing were not doing as great.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they got together, they got Jack Kirby over there, and that's when things kind of really took off.
Well, and I think part of what caused friction between Stan Lee and Jack Kirby came down to different viewpoints of what does it mean to write?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the plotting? Is it literally the scripting or the dialogue? When somebody says they wrote the book, to what level of involvement are they talking? And I think there are different interpretations of that.
Yeah.
They were using the same words but meaning very different things, and I think that caused some definite friction.
Mm-hmm.
But whether it was they got along swimmingly or they hated each other, either way, there is a point in time there at the beginning of the Marvel Universe where even though Captain America and various other characters pre-existed and were being leveraged to build foundational aspects of the Marvel Universe, that flurry of creativity, of energy, of interest, of salesmanship, that's why we have the Marvel Universe we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And Walk makes a point early on, or a claim early on, that other stories would be unthinkable without the Marvel Universe. And he specifically cites, I think it was Star Wars and something else, as just being, you know, Star Wars and Avatar and The Matrix would be unimaginable without it.
Mm.
And I'm like, if you're going to make a claim like that, don't just move on to the next topic. Back it up. Give me some reason to believe that.
Right.
So, there were a number of places where he would make some claims that I didn't feel he supported, he explained.
It would almost be like a headline, right? Like somebody says something that's like, oh my gosh, let me read about this. And then there's nothing, like the headline has no story. Right?
It's clickbait without the article behind it. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no article. It's just you click on it, you're like, oh, that's it?
Yeah, yeah. There were a couple of that. Well, and he'll make some offhand remarks, like the cut rate competitor, Carlton Comics and stuff. And it's like, well, what made them cut rate? That's kind of a negative connotation.
Right.
You know? And, you know, Lee wasn't the visionary creative powerhouse that Kirby and Ditko was. What are you going to back that up with? And the one I found hilarious, and I think this was in the Thor chapter,
mm-hmm.
he makes a comment of, it was page 183, quote, Lee's writing was going through an odd phase at this point. For some reason, he omitted punctuation from the end of most word balloons for a 3-month period in mid-1971. Now, was that Stan Lee, or could that have, I don't know, maybe been the letterers?
Right.
But again, he just puts it out there that Lee was going through this phase at this point. And I'm like, I don't see this being as strong of a connection as you maybe think it is and whatnot. And then some of the comments he makes about readers of comics.
Yeah.
I found those almost, he was trying to position himself as a comic fan, part of that crowd. Yet he refers to them as slanderous thing after slanderous thing, you know, that there were plenty of sophomoric retrograde stuff rushed out to serve an audience of credulous kids or bloodthirsty nostalgics. You know, and there's a ghastly part of comics culture that focuses on back issues as concrete financial investments. And there's a popular misconception among irritable mainstream comic readers that crossovers wreck the flow of an ongoing series, forcing them to interrupt their natural progression to conform to whatever big event comics are coming along the same month and stuff. And just he really just takes some pot shots at mm-hmm. readers and such. And those were, I think, some of the less annoying ones. He also falls into the trap, I think, many people do, of overgeneralizing, and that there's this mythical global consensus of the fan base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ask anybody and they will say.
Right.
He uses that exact phrasing at one point, and I'm like, really? We're all of a hive mind? So that one, that rubbed me the wrong way a number of times.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the first time I read, you know, one of those comments, it kind of took me aback a little bit, because I felt like I was, you know, I was getting into the groove of what I thought this book was going to be about. And then every now and again, there would be something like that. And it's kind of like a bucket of cold water. It's like, wait, I thought you were writing this book for comic fans, you know, like, it'd be these pot shots where you're just like, well, is this book for me? And is this book actually for me? You know, like somebody who wants to know more about the Marvel Universe, who's looking for hidden gems and the overall story so that it makes sense. And it just felt like I kept getting pushed out of the book, so to speak, when he would say things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the apex of that was all of his stuff on the bad faith arguments.
Right.
And that part, I mean, I get some of where he was going with some of that. I think there are some unfortunate, you know, nuggets of truth and whatnot in there, but he basically was suggesting if you hold certain opinions and don't like certain characters, that you are sexist, racist, and generally just a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other explanation. And he had similar attitudes towards some of the creators. And I really, on the creator side of it, he got in a lot of this in the Master of Kung Fu chapter. Of they had things that were very dated depictions of Asians, of various other things. They colored some of the Asians orange. And it's like, well, why did you do that? That seems racist or whatever. I mean, one, back then, it's not like they had the full color gamut we've got now.
Right.
Two, there were times that honest mistakes were made. They've apologized. They've tried to correct. But it seemed like at every opportunity, he cast it as they were small-minded racists and should be ashamed of themselves. And I'm like, damn, that's harsh.
Yeah. It was some pretty generalized and hard to read, you know, when you feel like somebody is putting something on, you know, blanket statement, and is kind of wrapping you up in that blanket statement. You're like, wait a minute, that's not the idea at all. So did you want to read any of those quotes, or do you just want to kind of leave it where we are?
There were a couple that were talking about legacy characters and, you know, if you didn't like the replacement, it's only because you were, say, sexist, racist, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he talks about, like, when the characters were replaced by other characters, so legacy characters, he was saying basically because they weren't, you know, the white men that they initially were, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I wanted to bring that up because, you know, for me, it's never been about that, right? So the whole legacy question, like for me, you know, you have, it has nothing to do necessarily with the color of the new character's skin. It's just the whole idea that original character is no longer that original character, right? So you have Bruce Banner, who is the Hulk, you know, Peter Parker is Spider-Man, Tony Stark is Iron Man, Steve Rogers is Captain America, Aurora Monroe is Storm, and T'Challa is Black Panther, right? So it's like, if you replace any of those characters with another character, it's not that same character. And so I don't think you should put that blanket statement out there and say, well, you don't like these legacy characters because of something superficial.
Well,
you know,
his exact quotes, it was around page 43, and I'm going to omit certain parts of it, but the key lines, that led to certain readers, generally older, whiter, and maler than otherwise, getting into the habit of making bad faith arguments about Marvel's comics in the mid-2010s. That kind of complaint almost always reads as code.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we can't be fans of the original without being considered, you know, an ist of some sort. And to me, it comes down to kind of Coy and Vance. And you're like, what the hell is he talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Fifth season of Dukes of Hazzard. Bo and Luke were out. They were wanting more money and stuff. They got replaced by the substitute Duke cousins of Coy and Vance. And I am willing to bet if you ask most fans of that show, what was the low point? That's the season they're going to talk to. Because they're not the real deal characters. And this isn't even a matter of they're a different ethnicity, gender, or younger, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the character.
Right. The original character is the original character. There cannot be a second original, right? And anytime they replace that original character with someone else, as much as they may carry on the legacy, and you know, things like the Justice Society of America that Geoff Johns was doing, like he had characters with the same name, but it was like their son or their nephew, or you know, like it would be more of a that type of legacy. Whereas, you know, in this case, it just, you know, I felt like it's more of like a, if you separate from the original character, it's just more of like a derivative and not as exciting as like, because you get attached to that original character, you know?
Yep. Well, but he flat out says, quote, it's that the new characters who tried on the roles weren't white men, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, for some reasons, readers, I'm sure that probably was true. But to categorically say it's true for everybody, I find offensive.
Right. And
incorrect.
And saying that they didn't, that they failed because everybody didn't like them, right? And it could have just been that maybe they didn't like the way the character was being written, or that character was being written as that original character. It is more of a surface level.
Well, let's take a DC example of Jason Todd.
Mm-hmm.
He was so beloved that they voted to kill him off the readership.
Right.
And granted, it was almost a 50-50 split, but still. And he was just as white as Dick Grayson.
Right.
You know? So again, you can't blame that. But to see that as the only possible explanation implies a definite mindset of the writer. And he then goes on to say that, quote, another bad faith question about legacy characters is, quote, why can't new comics be about totally new superhero characters, not derived in any way from existent ones? Don't legacy characters reveal an essential lack of creativity, quote, and this is still within the bigger quote, it's a bad faith argument because, given modern market conditions, series about characters who fit that description are nearly impossible to sell, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you argue that giving them the name of an existing one is kind of demeaning to that new character and potentially by extension that race, ethnicity, gender, whatever, again, bad faith argument because it just the market wouldn't allow it any other way. The market is racist, sexist, etc. And I'm like, you know, there have been some other characters that have done fine in that period. Not many. I agree with his comment about the market conditions being bad, but I don't think they're bad for characters of different ethnicities, religions, genders, whatever. I think it's bad all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a comment, if the last one they tried of this writing was 2016's Mosaic, which lasted only 8 issues. And that character wasn't going to work on any name, legacy or not, or whatever. That was just a bad execution of a not good concept.
Mm-hmm.
And he also mentions that the last one that Marvel published that caught on just as a new property or whatever was Runaways, and that debuted in 2005. Now, I take issue with that on a couple of points. One, I'm not going to necessarily say that was the last one that caught on. I will say it didn't catch on in 2005. Runaways number one had a cover date of July 2003.
Yeah.
Now, the second volume started in 2005, so maybe he just got confused there. But again, he is projecting reasoning into people to fit a narrative, it feels like. And again, are there racist, sexist comic book fans? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Are all of them that way? No. And I think it is basically a bad faith argument to claim that they are.
Mm-hmm.
And to basically be told as an older white male, I can't voice certain opinions because the only rational explanation must be I'm sexist, racist, or whatever, when there's a perfectly good other reason, again, annoying.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I found that whole bit. I think some other people that have reviewed it on like YouTube and stuff, this was the politics they were talking about.
Right, yeah. This is the politics that everybody, and the same thing with the Amazon reviews. You know, that's mainly what people have criticized, you know, for somebody who, in this case, he was trying to, I mean, the premise of the book, right? He's trying to get people to read comics, bring people that aren't familiar with comics. You know, that one section, I think it's chapter 2, he's talking about, you know, what is a trade paperback? What is a graphic novel? And kind of like breaks down some of that comic book jargon that we don't even think about when we're saying it. And kind of lowers those barriers for new readers. But if you're trying to, you know, if you talk about market conditions and trying to improve that and bringing in readers, so you want to keep your old readers. And yes, you definitely want to bring in the younger generation, getting those newer readers. But it would make sense that you wouldn't try to alienate one group to bring in a new group, right? You would try to get, you know, like keep the doors open for everybody. So everybody has something to enjoy.
Well, and again, to slam creators of the past as being evil, racist people, because of how they depict individuals and stuff in past comics. And I am by no means suggesting that all of the past depictions of various ethnicities and stuff have been remotely charitable, much less good in some cases. They've been horrific.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to look at it through the lens of the times and the people. I had one time I was visiting my grandparents at the retirement home they were in. And I overheard some people talking out in the hallway, because they had seen me and stuff, and one was telling the other how nice it is that I seem to love my cousins, even though they're Japanese. Just how wonderful that is. Now, you can look at that comment in many ways. One, they were saying, oh, it's great. I'm not looking at race. I'm clearly not a racist person or whatever. But the way they said it, you could argue kind of was.
Right.
Well, okay. You look at my age. I'm in my 50s. They were my grandparents' age, give or take. These are people who lived through World War II, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the war with Japan, all of that kind of stuff. Their views on the Japanese are going to be very different than people, say, of my generation, who think of Japan as all the place to get all the cool anime, computer stuff, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So have views changed over the generations for the better? Yes, certainly. But to judge people who lived under very, very different conditions and what was considered socially acceptable then and clearly should not have been and is not now, I don't know. There are ways to improve the situation without villainizing everybody in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt this book went whole hog on, if you don't like a character of ethnicity or because they're female or because they're not a white male, the only explanation is it was just, again, flooring.
Right. And just that alienation feeling of like, instead of like saying, you know, there's something here for everybody and just trying to be, you know, inclusive of bringing more people, you know, trying to bring as many people, you know, interested in, I mean, I could see, you know, a number of people reading that comment and being like, I'm done with this book. I don't care what are the comics he's talking about. I don't want to read anything else.
I was digging around doing a little research and I came across an interview with Mark Grunewald.
Mm-hmm.
And it was talking about how he came up with DP7 for the new universe, which is what got me to there. Cause I was trying to think, should the new universe have been included in the reading list here or not and stuff. But it also talked about part of Grunewald's run on Captain America.
Okay.
Specifically when John Walker became Captain America and there was a new Bucky.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that character of Bucky was chosen because John Walker was super patriot. It's like he had three sidekicks, so to speak. Let's pick one of them. Two were white guys, one was black. It's like, oh, black guy would be the unobvious pick. Let's go with that character. Cap's sidekick is Bucky. We'll call him Bucky. Well, not a good way to refer to a black man, and particularly to dress him up as a dead white boy and stuff like that. There's things that could definitely and rightfully be considered wrong with that. Well, in this thing, Mark Grunewald was addressing it, and he's like, I grew up in the Midwest. I knew maybe two black people or whatnot, had no idea this was offensive, had no idea until it was pointed out that here's what was wrong. And the minute it was, the light bulb clicked. He saw it. I got to fix it. That's how this guy became Battlestar.
He corrected it.
You know, well, and he was trying to do it for the right reasons. It's like, I could do another couple of white male guys, or I can pick the person of color. Let's get some representation. He was coming from the right place.
Right.
And, I mean, I'm not going to claim to have known Mark Grunewald well. I've met him a time or two at conventions and stuff. I'd be amazed if there was a not nice bone in his body, you know. But that was a creator who made a mistake, owned up to it, fixed it, and would fall under the villainization in this book, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's, yeah. There were a number of places in this book where I felt the author had a very opinionated point of view. Sometimes I just disagreed with it. Other times I thought they were flat out wrong. There were, again, a couple of, like I said, some factual errors, a couple of comments he made. At one point, he refers to the new Teen Titans as a knockoff of the X-Men.
I knew that would get you, John, when I read that.
And I'm like, damn! You know, because his quote was, you know, even knockoffs and parodies of the X-Men became hit. DC's comics' biggest success of that era was the very similar super team soap opera, The New Teen Titans. And he goes on to talk about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and stuff. And an argument could be made that that was just poor phrasing and that the parody knockoff thing was referring to the Turtles, not the Titans, but...
Yeah.
That's what he said.
But yeah, when I saw him mention the Titans, I immediately thought of you. And then I thought of myself, and of course you as well, but I was like, what about the Legion of Superheroes? They were selling really well at that time too, and he of course didn't mention them.
Yeah. Again, there were certain things that feel like omissions, and I feel his knowledge of DC is apparently fairly minimal, claiming it's not as big or not a shared universe or wasn't before Marvel was, etc. So yeah, there were some things like that that I was surprised by.
I wanted to ask you, John, Can we talk about the three chronologies now?
Yeah, let's talk about that. I thought that was actually some really insightful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish he had spent both more time on it and less time on it. Because his three chronologies are, one, the chronology of publication, the order the comics came out in. That's obvious. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely should be the first one. The second, the chronology of events within the story. The difference being flashbacks, flash forwards, things of that sort. Time travel even involves in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third, the chronology in which you read the story, because that's kind of your own headcanon, and I think the way you interpret certain stories is going to be different on the order you read them in. Because if you come with certain baggage, you're going to understand certain plot points or not understand them if you don't have the baggage.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really insightful, but it then felt like all of the rest of the book was almost solely focusing on that third chronology, which specifically was the order he seemed to read them in.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least that's how they were presented, so I don't know the order he read stuff in other than it was haphazard.
Now, like I said previously, I think the order of publication makes the most sense in terms of the type of project that he was trying to do. Like that, this extensive project of trying to understand the Marvel chronology, I mean, the Marvel story as a whole, as a some kind of a thematic narrative. So that definitely makes sense. I think trying to do it like in terms of the second chronology would be very confusing, because every time they come up with a different series that is set in the middle of, for example, if they tell a story of the X-Men First Class, which is back during the 60s, right? So you've got to like go back and read that, and then that could really kind of throw things off.
Well, I mean, the chronology of publication is set in stone based on when the books came out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes it's nonsensical, like when two issues of a Hawkeye series come out in the wrong order, or they number them backwards or something like that, but it's at least factual.
Right.
The chronology of events within the story is not only not factual, it's not stable.
It's ever-changing.
It's ever-changing, it's retconning, it is hideously confusing, and that's if it ever was able to make sense to begin with, which he claims it's trivial to figure that out. And I'm like, yeah, this continuity is nowhere near as cut and dry as you think it is.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the third one, like the third one makes sense, even though I don't necessarily consider it as a chronology. I consider that as how everybody discovers comics. Everybody discovers stories. They don't come in necessarily on Incredible Hulk 1, Fantastic Four 1. They come in when they see that book on the shelf, they grab it, and that's where their chronology starts. That's where their history of the character starts. But I don't know that I would necessarily consider that an actual chronology. You know what I mean? I think that's the way that you experience the story. And I guess maybe it would be, but...
Well, the other chronology he mentioned in passing at one point, and I think it might have been... I forget where it was, actually. Was the... It was in the chapter wrapping it up with his son and stuff, I think. But it was around the order the characters experience the events in.
Mm, yes.
Definitely time travel comes into play there.
Right.
And retcons certainly come into there. So, to me, the first and the third are stable chronologies in so much as they were published when they were published, you read them when you read them. But when I read them versus when you read them are going to be different. The baggage we came into them with is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that is why his haphazard reading of this almost precluded any semblance of him being a decent tour guide, because he didn't have that cohesive big picture.
Right.
If you're reading stuff out of order, you're going to make some comments that you may not have made if you understood the true timeline of, say, Spider-Man and some stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised he mentioned the fourth one elsewhere and not having included it here. And again, it felt like he referenced the chronology of publication, never even attempted to do anything about the chronology of events within the story, and filtered too much of the book through his own reading lens.
Mm-hmm.
Jason and I talked for over 3 hours on this book, so I'm going to break the conversation here, and we'll pick it up again next week.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.